Welcome to the Issue Is podcast this week. I'm so humbled by the fact that we're able to talk to so many big people this week. It's really been an extraordinary week. We have conversations with Cory Booker, Oscar-winning actress Patricia Arquette, Congresswoman Katie Hill, plus a great panel with Anna Kasparian, Carson Jones, and John Thomas. But let's begin with Cory Booker, who is the New Jersey senator, former Rhodes Scholar, former Newark mayor, former Stanford tight end, who has really had presidential buzz about him for years, has kind of been towards the bottom of the top tier or top of the middle tier in terms of the presidential race, and a real breakout moment at the California convention last weekend when he talked about gun control. We talked with him backstage moments after that sort of thunderous applause from all the California delegates about gun control, about immigration, about his California roots, about some personal issues, about his girlfriend. So here is our full, unedited conversation with Senator Booker. Senator Cory Booker, welcome to the Issue Is.
Alex, it's really good to be on.
All right, so welcome back to California. I know you went to Stanford. Your mom went to USC. I went to USC as well, so fight on to you.
I scored a touchdown against you guys, and so I'm going to flex a little bit here as a Stanford tight end.
And your finger shows some of the...
I've got some pretty messed up hands from days of football and basketball.
That shows you're a good player.
Yeah.
So talk to us about why you, because that's the big basic question for most voters. There's so many options. Why you?
Well, it's two things. I have a unique resume in this election. I ran towards the toughest problems in our country. I left Yale Law School, moved to the inner city of Newark, New Jersey, where I still live, joined myself with others in a city that had a reputation for decay and corruption and crime, and we turned it around. We, very important, we brought together new coalitions to create transformative results. I was the chief executive, who then went to Washington and was told what we couldn't do there. But we passed major bipartisan legislation. In fact, the only major bipartisan bill to pass under this president was the one I led from the Democratic Senate side with Dick Durbin for criminal justice reform. So that's a unique resume, somebody who was a chief executive and somebody who's gotten things done in Washington. But that's the first point. The second point is, I'm also the guy that says, hey, we're not going to win this election by just talking about what we're against. We need to start talking about what we're for. And Democrats, this is a moment where we have to be really a moral voice in this moral moment that is not about more tribalism and us against them politics or zero-sum game, fear-based politics. We need to change the culture of our country from tribalism back to the beloved community to pull this country together to deal with issues of injustice. And that's the theme of my campaign. If you want somebody, when they go low, we go lower, you can pick another candidate. If you want somebody who wants to fight fire with fires, I ran a fire department in Newark, not a good strategy, but hey, there are other people that can fit that bill. I want to call us to the best of who we are, not the worst, and that will beat Donald Trump, because he wants us to fight him in the gutter on his turf, on his terms. This is a moment we got to call us to a higher level and a higher fight.
We had Kim Kardashian on the show recently, and she said nice things about your work on criminal justice reform.
I'm so happy to hear that. Yes, I never got a compliment from Kim Kardashian before. I must be making it now.
Let's talk though about California itself.
Yes.
A big state, a complicated state. You're going up against a vice president who is well known by everybody. The senator who's a friend of yours, who's endorsed by almost everybody here. How do you pull it off here, and how important is California to the overall strategy?
Well, again, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for California. That's how important it was. My grandfather and grandmother, they got jobs out here, worked on assembly lines, worked for California government. So I'm invested in this state heavily, and we're going to take on this state. And a lot of that's going to be the momentum we're going to build. We're looking forward to peaking late, like Obama, who upset, or Kerry, who upset. They were polling way behind at this point in an election. We're going to win in Iowa. We're going to win in New Hampshire. Come through South Carolina and Nevada with a lot of momentum coming into California. So California's going to have a lot of time to learn more about me, about my vision, about my platforms, my ability to win retail states, because I'm a retail guy. But more importantly, I think that this long campaign, Californians will have a front row view of who best can beat Donald Trump and bring our country to a higher level.
So our show is called The Issue Is, so let's talk about some issues, right?
Yes.
And I know one that you're so passionate about is the issue of gun control. Senator Harris here and Congressman O'Rourke recently said that we should have an executive action and it should be an assault weapons ban by executive action. Do you agree with that? And do you think that's even constitutional to do something like that?
Well, folks should know, and I hope they'll go to CoryBooker.com, we have a far bigger and bolder agenda that has about 20 different points to it that are evidence-based things that work, that include an assault weapon ban, that include things like licensing for guns like Connecticut did that dropped their homicide rates 40%, suicide rates 15%. It involves investing in communities because there's models that when you see this as a public health issue, like Oakland did, you can drive down gun violence by investing in severely impacted communities. So to me, it's about a larger, bolder vision that's not letting the corporate gun lobby define this debate by small ambitions and small goals.
But can a president do that on his own, or does Congress need to be involved with that? Because Republicans have shown no willingness to do that.
Well, first of all, I think the right leader, like we saw in the civil rights movement, remember, Congress wouldn't pass civil rights laws. Strom Thurmond has a record for the longest filibuster in the Senate stopping civil rights legislation. But we overcame that by having leaders that inspired us to action. And so I'm not taking anything. I believe we can bring a fight to this issue like that's never been seen before with the right leader. I live in an inner city, low-income neighborhood where we see shrines to dead children on the streets. I have literally sat at a child's side trying to stop them from bleeding to death after a gun violence. This is an issue for a black man in America, where we're 6% of the nation's population but make up over 50% of the homicide victims. I'm sorry, enough is enough. We will win this battle. If I'm your president, I'm going to bring a fight with you to this battle like it's never been seen before as a country, and we will find a way to get it done like we did in movements past.
Another issue that had been a complete logjam in Congress is that of immigration, which is so important here in California. What's the winning formula there? How do you get Republicans to sign off on immigration reform there? Is there actually a place for bipartisan compromise?
Well, there is. We saw it right before I came to the Senate. They did a bipartisan immigration reform bill that passed the Senate that would have literally taken $1 trillion off of our deficit, massive increases in revenue for our city, pulled people out of shadows, given people pathways to citizenship. So it can be done. In recent history, we did it. But this is what we've allowed. We've allowed demagoguery, fear-mongering to corrupt our politics. We have a president that is literally engaging in the worst kind of moral vandalism and trying to use and pit Americans against Americans. So the cure to this is waking up Americans, more Americans, joining in the understanding that we are a great nation, not despite immigration, but because of immigration. And if we're going to compete globally, we need to stop kicking Stanford kids who come in to the best education on the planet Earth, which a lot of it exists here in California, and then when the student visa's up, we kick them out. Understanding that here in California, your agricultural industry relies on the hard work and dedication of immigration. I can go through the areas where we know we are dependent upon immigration. And so we need to get back to facts and what makes us a better and stronger society and have a politics that heals this bigotry and xenophobia we're seeing and begins to help us get back to the bipartisan work we did before in the Senate and make sure we pass comprehensive immigration reform now.
Another industry that's so important to California is technology. Some have criticized you for being too close to Silicon Valley, calling you Silicon Valley Senator. What do you make of that? And what do you make of, like, Senator Warren suggesting that we should break up big tech?
Well, two things. If you went to Stanford in the early 90s, you kind of know people that are in Silicon Valley. Yeah. Some of my friends started some of the companies we know. So I'm not going to deny my friendships with people, but I will say this. If you want to talk about a senator that is about holding people accountable and has been fighting to revive our antitrust laws and that sees Silicon Valley both for the opportunity that they are, but on things like data security, privacy, foreign attacks, these are platforms that are being used for some things that are unacceptable, and we need to have regulation. And we need to have a president that's committed to using antitrust laws, because we've seen too much corporate consolidation in pharma and the agriculture industry and more. So, I got into politics to represent low-income communities. I'm the only person in the United States Senate that lives in a community below poverty line. I'm going to fight for the interests of those people who have been overlooked, looked down upon, and left aside. And I'm going to make sure that for corporations, which have been in so many ways since Citizens United, perverting our politics with an obscene amount of cash. That's why my whole campaign is saying we're not taking corporate PAC money, we're not taking federal lobbyist money, not taking big pharma money, not taking oil company money. We're going to fight to make sure that we hold companies accountable. I don't care who's leading them.
But is Facebook too big? I mean, Chris Hughes has suggested that Facebook co-founder. Is it too big?
And I think that Chris Hughes and so many others are right to say that here's a company that controls, in fact, there's a couple companies that control overwhelmingly the majority of online ads. We should have a Justice Department that is looking into those things and using our laws to hold them accountable. But I'll tell you this, I don't want to be one of those presidents that just says, picks on companies individually. We should have processes that enforce antitrust laws, that enforce the laws that stop oligarchies from undermining our system. And I'm going to be a president from my DOJ to my FTC that actually fights the right way to hold pharma, tech, oil companies, to hold these companies accountable.
You've been out on the road for some time now, doing a lot of town halls, talking to a lot of people, and learning from people.
Yes.
What do you think is the most surprising or important lesson you've learned from voters out on the road that you didn't know before you started this process?
You know, I think the best lesson that I say all the time and voters say all the time is enough of the days where we're going to wait for a president to save us. We've seen this before. What we need right now is Americans to understand that we need us, each other. That if we sleep on our democracy, bad things happen. And we need a higher level of engagement in this political process that we have. And if that's the case, we're not going to just win the White House back, but we're going to win Senate seats and state legislatures back. And we're going to stop gerrymandering and stop the corruption of money in our politics. We're going to be able to do big things because we as communities got involved again in politics. California showed that in 2018. You won multiple House seats that were considered Republican seats. You took back, hell, we've got now Nancy Pelosi is the head of the first ever woman elected a Speaker of the House, is reelected because of the engagement of people. It wasn't done by a leader. So this has got to be a revival of our democracy to stop all the anti-democratic things that are happening in our country.
What do you think is the biggest misconception about you?
Besides the fact people don't realize I once had an amazing afro. No, look, I just think that we're finding out when people get to know who I am, or for people who know me, our approval rates are way off the charts. The battle for me is just to get people, take the time to get to know me. Learn about my history. Go and watch Netflix, that Oscar-nominated documentary, Street Fight, done about my first election. Go and look at what I did to turn a city around. What have I done in Congress? Who I've been standing up for? So I'm just looking forward to getting people a chance to get to know me. Remember, rarely have we had a Democratic nominee win who's polling ahead this far out. Usually it's people that over time people get to know and learn about, and then they end up upsetting in Iowa. That's our pathway to the presidency, and I'm hoping people take the time to learn about my history, learn about my past, because that's the best prologue for what you can do. I'm the guy in this race who didn't take an easy way into politics. I ran at the toughest problems we have in America, created new coalitions to produce incredible results.
Yeah, of course, that was Barack Obama's path. All right, so we do something on our show called Personal Issues, where we have a little bit of fun, where we get to know you a little bit. So we're going to ask some of those questions, okay?
Please.
So here we go. Favorite comedian?
Wow, Richard Pryor. I grew up listening to his records. My mom and dad, I used to have to sneak in to listen, so they didn't hear me listening to that language.
Favorite road snack?
Road snack.
Yeah, you're on the road all the time.
Listen, when I'm trying to be healthy, it's probably carrot sticks. When I'm not, it's probably like kettle corn popcorn.
Favorite Star Wars character?
I love the Jedi Knights, man. So I'm going to say definitely Luke Skywalker.
Favorite actor or actress?
Wow, Rosario Dawson, my girlfriend.
Yeah, that was an easy one. Favorite president of all time?
I would have to say FDR.
First concert?
Lena Horne, who is just amazing, amazing. But I still remember as a kid going to see The Wiz, which isn't really a concert, it's a musical, but that music literally so affected me as a kid.
And finally, who's your role model?
My mom. She is Wonder Woman. The older I get, the more in awe I am of her. A successful executive for IBM, but she never stopped serving. She led nonprofits. Even when she was in retirement, she led a homeless organization. She was involved in the civil rights movement, helped to organize a march on Washington. She was just, for me, she is my role model. And it's just, I'm honored to have been raised by two great parents, but this powerful black woman so affected me. And she has a saying that embarrasses me on the campaign trail all the time. She says, behind every successful child is an astonished parent. and my prayer is that I can continue to astonish my mother with what her love has helped me to spread that love to the world.
Well, as a mama's boy, I can appreciate that.
Thank you. Thanks.
Shout
so
out to her.
Thank
Our thanks to Senator Booker. Also this week, the big story, homelessness. We got the homeless count came out. It was even worse than what officials here thought. Homelessness up 16% in L.A. City, up 12% in L.A. County, up 43% in Orange County, up 28% in Ventura County. It's such a big issue up and down the state. So the question is, are these policies working? We were reached out to by Katie Hill's team. She is the congresswoman representing Simi Valley, Santa Clarita, Lancaster, Agua Dulce. She has a lot of experience in this issue. Before she was in Congress, she ran a nonprofit called PATH, which was all about homelessness and trying to end homelessness. It's probably the issue she's most passionate about. So we spoke to her this week about those new numbers. Here's what she had to say.
Congresswoman, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
So what is your reaction to the latest numbers?
My reaction is that this isn't too much of a surprise, to be honest with you. And so many of us who had advocated for Measure H and Prop HHH, the resources that we've invested in the city and county of Los Angeles recently, is, you know, we knew that homelessness is a huge problem that's been decades in the making, and it's not going to be solved overnight, but that we have to do something. I think about it in the same way that I think about climate change and wildfires. You know, we have to deal with the problem that we're facing right now, which is people, you know, tens of thousands of people who are sleeping on the streets, but we also have to address the systemic factors that are causing homelessness in the first place. And we have not really been able to address those problems, you know, the systemic factors. The issue, or the ballot initiatives on Prop HHH and Measure H have been able to help with the immediate need. But we've got, you know, massive issues related to overall housing affordability, to income inequality, to, you know, the fact that people are living just a paycheck away from losing their housing, and that more people are becoming homeless than we're able to get out of homelessness. So I think that it hopefully is a wake-up call to people that, yes, the programs that we've put into place are working. We're housing more people than we ever have before, but we have to do more. And part of that needs to be a commitment coming from our federal government.
Well, right now, the state of California is led by Democrats. The city of Los Angeles is led by Democrats. LA County is led by Democrats. And yet this problem continues to get worse. Is this a failure of liberalism? Is it a failure of Democratic politics that this keeps getting worse?
No, not at all. This is finally, now that we have this leadership in place, we have people who are willing to take on the problem. And I have to give so much credit to our political leaders right now in the city and county of Los Angeles who have taken this on. It takes a lot of courage. We knew from the very beginning that taking on the issue of homelessness, no matter what you do, it doesn't matter how much money you put into it, you will not solve homelessness in a short period of time. You will not solve homelessness in the period of any political term. And the fact that, you know, Eric Garcetti was willing to take this as his signature issue is a real testament to how much he cares about the issue and how he was willing to put the political risks aside because he felt like it was such a crisis and it's something that we had to address. So, you know, to me, this is and frankly, I think that really this is so important for people to understand. We are finally getting the investment and the willingness to address this issue head on from our state and local officials. And I'm so proud to be part of a community, you know, across the entire state of California that is prioritizing this in the way that it needs to. But you can't fix it alone. You can't fix it alone with, you know, state and local investment. It has to be part of an overarching plan on how we're dealing with these systemic factors. And it's, you know, homelessness is not a simple issue. It's a compound of a broken system. And we have to look at it in its entirety, and that's something that I feel like my role in Congress and my mandate in Congress is to really address this, because there are not very many people who have the expertise that I have, and we know solutions that work. We know the kinds of things that we need to be investing in, but the reality is that it takes a commitment, it takes resources, and you know, I think that this is, hopefully we're hitting a moment in time where we're hitting a critical mass, and people are paying attention to it in a way that they haven't before, and recognizing that we cannot continue to push this down the road. We have to address this now, because the problem is only going to get worse. It will not get better until we address the underlying causes.
So as we mentioned, before you were in Congress, you were dealing with homelessness on the ground. What was the most important lesson you learned from that experience that you think other people may not know when it comes to the issue of homelessness?
I would say there are a couple of major lessons, one of which is you hear this myth a lot that people want to be homeless, and that's simply not true.
Some folks do.
No, they don't. That you will hear that because they might be pushing back to resistance to services because they've had such a bad experience in the past, or they're dealing with addiction or mental health issues. The thing that I try to equate this to is that nobody in you know, a stable state of mind is going to willfully choose to live on the streets. That's just not how it works. So people really do need to kind of recognize that we have to have a system that's set up to meet people where they're at and figure out what it's going to take to ensure that they are able to access the resources and that we're going to them to help them get into the services that they need, into the housing that they need, and not put it as like, oh, well, they're too hard to serve or they are just somebody who doesn't want housing, because it's just simply a false narrative. It's something that we have to reject outright. And create our programs and our philosophy behind it without that as kind of the basis for it. But the second thing is, people you would never guess are homeless are, and people you would never guess are just a paycheck away from becoming homeless are. And we currently, when the economy is doing well, you know, we have record lows for unemployment, and you know, things just overall in the economy look pretty great. But when that's the case, you actually have higher rents and lower vacancy rates, and the pressures that for people at the margins are so much more significant that you end up having more people become homeless, right, not the other way around. So we've invested a lot historically. When we hit a recession, for example, there was a massive investment in the homelessness, right, prevention and rapid rehousing program at the federal level previously. In the 2009 American Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
Yes.
But that is not when you need it the most. You need it the most when the economy is doing well.
All right, last question, because I'm running out of time. In 20, 30 seconds, the most important thing that we need to do going forward on homelessness.
The most important thing we need to do is A, stay the course with the local investments, and B, really put the pressure on our federal officials to do their part at the national level.
All right, Congresswoman Katie Hill, thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Katie Hill. So after all of that, there's a lot to discuss with our panel. Here they are. So let's start by talking about the 2020 race. We talked to Cory Booker. What was your take on that?
Cory Booker is going to have a difficult time standing out from the rest of the candidates, especially at a time when the issue of income inequity and climate change is really at the forefront of what Democratic voters want to focus on. His pet issue seems to be gun control, which is important. I'm not trying to take that away. But I think when you're differentiating Cory Booker with other Democratic candidates, that issue might not really, you know, rise to the top of the priorities.
Although it certainly got a great reaction at the California convention. Where do you see the race right now, John?
Cory has a good chunk of work to do. I think the race right now really is Biden is at his peak. I think he's only going to fall. The question is, how fast does he fall? I don't see him getting the nomination. I think Sanders and Warren I'm watching very closely because they're talented candidates. They have base of support. Booker is going all in on Iowa with a firewall in South Carolina. Booker's challenge is he doesn't score big points with big speeches. He's not a great television politician, but he's a good retail politician. So if he can win one room at a time and pull an upset in Iowa, he could get in this, but that's a really tough thing to do.
Carson, we know your dad has endorsed Joe Biden. You haven't endorsed anybody yet. It's a lot of candidates out there. Where do you see the race?
Yeah, there's a lot of candidates, and I think that I'm excited to see debates happen and a lively discussion about where we are on each of these issues and what each of these candidates are going to do for people in America. We really need to hear from them about what their specific plans are so that we can figure out who the strongest candidate moving forward is.
All right, so around the table,
who
do you think is the strongest candidate? Who would be the toughest opponent for President Trump?
I'm undecided on that. I think it's way too early. We need to wait and see in the first debate.
I would probably say Kamala Harris, only because I think she animates the traditional Democratic coalition, just with her identity.
What do you think?
I think it's way, way, way too early. There's a long time until March or all those times when the primaries are going to happen.
Well, one thing it's not too early to do is to try to fix homelessness in this state, because it continues to be a horrible problem. This week, the news even worse. Katie Hill saying that this is proof, though, that Democratic policies are working on homelessness. What do you make about John?
I took a lot of gall for her to say what she said on your interview. Proof that it's working when millions and millions of dollars are being spent and homelessness is skyrocketing in LA County, what, 16% or 14%? That is disastrous. The issue is, it's not just housing. You have to look at disastrous liberal policies in this state that cost of housing. And it's not just that. It's cost of living, gas taxes, sales taxes, all of that in the aggregate. There was an analysis done by the LA Times that said in order just to afford housing in LA County, the average person needs to earn $42 an hour. Mm. Well, that has to come down, and that means reduced regulatory burden, reduced taxes. But the sad part is I don't see that happening anytime soon.
So this is a topic that I care a lot about, and I've done a lot of extensive research because I'm tired of seeing my fellow Americans out on the streets. So what I found was that, you know, there's this talking point that we keep hearing over and over again in California about how there's a lack of inventory. There's a lack of inventory. We need to loosen zoning regulations and build more apartments. But the reality is we are in a construction boom right now. Last year, we built hundreds of thousands of units. But the only issue is, and these are not liberal policies, it's the, the marriage of corporations and our politicians. And this is a virus that really impacts every party, because we're having these developers come in, knock down affordable housing, and then build these luxury condos that people can't afford. And at the same time, we're allowing foreign investment into our housing market. And these are individuals who have no interest in actually living here. They're, in some cases, laundering money in U.S. property, and they're artificially inflating the value of property here in the U.S.
You have a bunch of empty condos in downtown Los Angeles.
That's right.
Now because of that. So that problem continues. Meanwhile, the reason to celebrate this weekend, though, Gay Pride. It's Gay Pride Month, and it's being celebrated in West Hollywood this weekend. What does gay pride mean to you? I want to go around the table, Anna, we'll start with you.
For me, it means living your life authentically and being unafraid to be yourself.
I mean, the Republican in me thinks it's great to have liberty and freedom to choose. So it's great that, for a celebration. And I'm actually happy to see that I think this issue, by and large, is behind us. It's something you can't forget. But I think the country as a whole is moving past this, and both parties seem to be embracing the freedom to choose.
Carson.
I think that this month is a great opportunity to look back at history and see how far our community has come. I think it's a great opportunity to be visible for people who may be struggling with their sexuality or may need that community. And it's also a good opportunity to look forward at where the areas of concern still are and what we can all do together to kind of fix those.
And what do you think is the most important thing to do going forward?
I think the beginning of it is looking at discrimination laws throughout the state or throughout the country. So especially on things like the Equality Act, as you move across the country, discrimination laws are completely different from state to state. So things like that can be really helpful to make sure that we are giving people the support that they need.
Yeah, and you will be out this weekend showcasing some of that support as well.
Absolutely.
It's good to have all of you here. Finally this week, we talked with Patricia Arquette, the Oscar-winning actress. You know her from Boyhood, so many other projects. There's a lot of talk that she's going to win the Emmy again this year. But it's her activism that she's perhaps most passionate about. We spoke at the Feminist Majority Foundation event in West Hollywood, and here is what she told us.
Patricia Arquette, welcome to The Issue Is.
Thank you.
So you're pushing right now for the Equal Rights Amendment. Why is that so important for America?
Well, I think it's really critical that women are enshrined in the Constitution. Supreme Court Justice Scalia said certainly the Constitution doesn't require discrimination on the basis of sex. The question is whether it prohibits it. It does not. Or it doesn't. Okay, so you have a recent Supreme Court justice that sees the Constitution from the time it was written. And that may very well be the case with Kavanaugh, for all we know. So what happens? Then you have cases come before the court, and they see them through that view. Now you think, oh, well, women have equal rights in America. What's going on? I don't know. Do women really have equal rights in America? In 7 states, women can be forced to co-parent with their convicted rapists. Every single state had rape kits with the DNA of rapists that were unprocessed, because the majority of victims are women. A lot of them got thrown away, sat on shelves for years. Meanwhile, these serial rapists just kept raping women. Why is it such a low budget priority to process these rape kits? Why are all these hospitals not trained in how to deal with this simple, normal trauma of rape that so many people experience? And yet rape victims are sometimes charged for their rape treatment. They're sent from hospital to hospital. Oftentimes, hospitals don't even know how to take the evidence from them. How can this be happening?
Do you find it amazing that there's even an argument back that there shouldn't be an Equal Rights Amendment?
Yeah, I find it really shocking and disturbing. I mean, even when I spoke in front of the Senate, you know, they were sort of coming up with excuses like, we don't need to say that women have equal rights. Their fear is that if they do that, it will strengthen abortion rights. But here's my argument. You didn't want to put us in the Constitution intentionally before there was any conversation about abortion rights. Then in the 70s, when people were on the precipice of having abortion rights, you didn't want us to have them. Now that abortion is legal as of today, federally in the United States of America, you still don't want us to have equal rights. The truth is, they just don't want us to have equal rights. There's always some excuse.
Where do you see the state of women's rights in 2019?
I think we have a long way to go, and I think we're seeing that demonstrated every day across the country. But it's not just abortion rights. Laws are being passed. There's things called nuisance laws in certain states, and in these states, if someone calls the police more than three times, you can get evicted. So a woman ended up trying to call the police on her stalker and abuser, who then moved into her apartment. She didn't want him there. She could no longer call the police. He's just living in her house. She can't even go home because she'll be evicted. It's crazy.
How do you think that citizens should respond to what's happening in all of these states when it comes to abortion rights? Some have said Hollywood should boycott. Alyssa Milano talked about a sex boycott. What do you think people should do as a reaction to what's happening on abortion rights?
Well, I think you need to vote these people out of office if you don't agree with their stance on abortion. I think you need to donate if you feel powerfully or strongly that women should have safe, legal abortion access in the United States, then donate money to the groups that are working hard to make that possible. And definitely vote these people out. Volunteer, find out who's running opposite them, work together with your friends, and advocate and talk to people about it.
Something else that's different about this year compared to other years is not only is a woman running for president, a bunch of women are running for president against each other. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that dynamic, the multiple female candidates?
I think it's very exciting. I mean, we just had record numbers of women elected. I mean, we're still far behind other parts of the world in so many areas, equal pay and representation in government and many different things. But I think it's exciting that all these women are coming into office. I think Hillary Clinton probably dealt with a lot of more subconscious misogyny than we really are aware of or have really examined as a culture. But I feel like these women can move a little further because of all the flack that she took. Mm-hmm. Somehow that's kind of normalized people to a certain extent of the idea of female leadership at that level.
Is there one you're especially excited about?
I have some people, but I don't want to pick vocally at this point. Whoever ends up being the nominee, I'm going to support them.
What is your message to President Trump when it comes to women's rights?
I don't even know where to begin. It's very dangerous. I think President Trump's party, the policies that they're passing, these laws in these states, have absolutely no respect for women. Or the fact that a young girl in a state can get raped by her grandfather and impregnated and forced to give birth to that baby, and if she leaves the state and gets an abortion, she'll serve more time than her grandfather would for raping her and impregnating her is crazy.
Is there any part of you that ever would want to run for office?
That's so funny. People ask me that all the time.
Yeah, because you're such a great articulate spokesperson for what you believe in.
I actually talked to my family about it last year, and they were not very excited about that idea. They were like, really? And the truth is, I feel like I can be very vocal right now, where I think I would have to be a little more strategic about things that I would say probably if I was in an elected position.
And just as we wrap up, sort of a bottom line message you want to leave people with, the most important message you have.
This is your country. You have got to be engaged. This country is in great danger in many, many areas. We're in danger because the Russians attacked us and continue to attack us. Our election systems are not secure. And there's been no nationwide audit, and there never can be, because all of these companies that do electronic voting claim that it's like secrets of the trade. Mm-hmm. So nobody can really even look at it. We know voter rolls are electronic. That's incredibly dangerous. People can be added or their information changed and get kicked off of rolls. So everybody needs to wake up and be really engaged in every era. Every vote should matter in the United States of America. Every American should matter. And our country needs to matter. Let's start there. Our country needs to matter. The women in this country need to matter. Our votes need to be our own and our own country's votes of our own citizens. These are very important times, and people need to pick a country that they're fighting for. And I'm hoping that you'll choose America.
Thank you very much for sharing your views and for being such an articulate spokesperson for what you believe in.
Thank you
for advocating.
Well, thank you for being here and for asking me these questions. Thank you.
Thank you to Patricia Arquette, to Cory Booker, to Katie Hill, to Anna Kasparian, to John Thomas, to Carson Jones. What a big week of conversations. Thank you to listening to all of it. Hopefully you've learned a little bit more about all of them. Our podcast extra this week is with Carson Jones. We find out about what it's like growing up in Alabama, what's like growing up gay in Alabama, why he became a zookeeper, what it was like being in the middle of that crazy race with Roy Moore, what it was like to have to meet Mike Pence in the middle of being sworn in, his father being sworn in, where he sees politics going. It's a really interesting conversation with a young man who suddenly has a national profile. That is in our podcast extra. We'll hope you listen to that. We hope you subscribe to our podcast. And please tell people about us. If you like what we do, please share out the word in social media. We're sort of a little show that could, and we're all in this together. We believe in it, and we hope can use your help in trying to get the word out there. And feel free to send me a note with what you like and what you don't like. We love hearing from you. I'm Alex Michelson. You can find me on social media at Alex Michelson. Thanks so much for listening to The Issue Is.